This is the TriDot Podcast. TriDot uses your training data and genetic profile combined with predictive analytics and artificial intelligence to optimize your training, giving you better results in less time with fewer injuries. Our podcast is here to educate, inspire, and entertain. We'll talk all things triathlon with expert coaches and special guests. Join the conversation and let's improve together.
Welcome to the TriDot Podcast. Today, we'll be venturing into the land of heart rate zones and beats per minute, bravely exploring the things our heart is trying to tell us from moment to moment as we work out. Joining us to talk through all of this is TriDot coach Ryan Tibble. Ryan has a BS in biomedical sciences from Texas A&M University and respiratory care from UT Health Center in San Antonio. He serves as the head power cycle coach at Lifetime Fitness and is a certified CrossFit coach and a Pose Method certified run coach. Ryan is a multiple-time Ironman finisher and has been coaching with TriDot since 2015. He's even more involved with the TriDot team now as a TriDot business coach in helping match coaches with TriDot athletes who want a coach. How about that? Coach Ryan, welcome back to the show.
So excited, Andrew. Ready to give all my heart into this episode. Maximum effort. Can't wait for what Reigns has to say.
Yeah, no, me too, because also with us is Coach Jeff Reigns. Jeff is a USAT Level 2 and Ironman U certified coach who is a Master of Science in Exercise Physiology and was a D1 collegiate runner. He has over 50 Ironman event finishes to his credit and has coached hundreds of athletes to the Ironman finish line. Jeff has been training and coaching with TriDot since 2015. What's up, Jeff?
What's up, Drewski? You know, with a title like Listen to Your Heart, we should have had the Roxette song playing in the background during this.
I'm Andrew, the average triathlete, voice of the people, and captain of the middle of the pack. As always, we'll roll through our warm-up question, settle in for our main set topic, and then wind things down with our cool-down.
Have you planned your nutrition strategy yet for your next race? If you are in need of some help, our friends at Precision Fuel and Hydration provide education, tools, and products to help you personalize your fueling plan. Precision Fuel and Hydration work with some of the best triathletes in the world, and their products are used by elite athletes at the PTO Tour races. You, too, can refine your hydration and fueling strategy just like the pros. If you can't get to one of their sweat testing centers, use their free online fuel and hydration planner to get a personalized race nutrition plan. And from there, you can book a free one-on-one video consultation with their athlete support team to start refining your training and racing strategy. Don't forget, TriDot listeners get 10% off their first order of electrolytes and fueling products by using the code TRY23 at the checkout.
Time to warm up. Let's get moving.
There are tons of items on the market that triathletes can use to fuel with, swim with, bike with, run with, recover with, and accessorize with. Not everything on the tri market will fit our taste and our needs, however. So with that truth in mind, what is one triathlon item that on principle or maybe just by preference you would refuse to use even if it was given to you for free? Coach Ryan Tibble, what is this for you?
Oh man, that's a really good question. You know what? I'm a no to Buoyancy shorts. Band-aid, okay. You know, it feel like it's a band-aid to an inefficient kick and body position in water. It is one of those things that as we're learning to swim and really working our proficiency in the water, I think using buoyancy shorts really throws off your balance tremendously. I've had firsthand experience seeing that in swimmers. And as soon as I took those shorts off, I have seen such a marked improvement when actually not using them. So there's my answer.
All right. So if one of those neoprene brands came to you and said, "Hey, Ryan, we want to make you the poster boy for our buoyancy shorts. Here is a bunch of money to sponsor them and use them." You would say, "Nope, I am a no buoyancy shorts guy myself." Okay, I respect that. I get that. Coach Jeff Reigns, what is this answer for you?
I think I'm going to also dabble here in the swim category. I'm going to say swim caps. I'm an advocate of them. I wear them in the race. I always wear them in open water for visibility and safety. So I'm not I'm not knocking that by any means, but just everyday swimming in a pool, I do not wear them. I don't know if they bother me. I know they help me cut through the water, probably shave a second per 100 and all of that. But day-to-day training, I just don't wear swim caps.
For me, this answer is Martin gels. This is really simple. It's not them, it's me. Martin gels are great. Plenty of people use them successfully at the races and in their training. Obviously, they're the official gel on course at Ironman. So with that in mind, when I was getting ready for Ironman Waco, I was like, let me get a sample pack of Martin gels and let me see if I like them. Because if I like them, I don't have to carry my own gels on course. And I got that sample box in and I went to knock back that very first Martin gel. And here's the thing, y'all. I have kind of a decently sensitive gag reflex. I was the kid who like had to have laughing gas at the dentist to get through a dentist procedure. I've largely outgrown that for the most part. But something about those Martin gels and kind of that like chunky jello consistency they are, just totally like instantly, like it hit my mouth and I instantly was gagging on the bike trainer in my pain cave. I could not get it down. It's not them. It's not their fault. It's my fault. If you use those, good for you. I'm going to stick to my Precision Fuel and Hydration PF30 gels myself. And I even at Ironman Waco, I took at one point one of the Martin gels on course. I grabbed it from an aid station. Just I knew I was about 4 or 5 miles away from the personal needs where I had more of my own gels. And I was like, okay, let me grab one of these just in case I might need it to get back home. And I never even used it because I knew if I tried, it would not go very well. So that's it for me. You could give me a whole box of those things and I would be taking that and re-gifting it to somebody else.
I was going to say, I'll take them.
Yeah. I'll keep that in mind. If someone ever comes along with a dump truck of Martin gels, I will send them to your house and not mine. So deal. We're going to throw this question out to you, everybody, on the I Am Trout Facebook group. Make sure you're a part of that group. We have just thousands of athletes talking swim, bike, and run every single day of the week in that group. Every Monday when the new show comes out, I pose the warm-up question to you, our audience. So check out the post asking you, if you were given a triathlon item for free, what is something that you would just refuse to use because it just doesn't quite jive with who you are? Can't wait to see what you have to say.
On to the main set. Going in 3, 2, 1.
We are thrilled to have Sailfish as the swim partner of Trout Out Training. Sailfish was founded in 2007 by Jan Sibbersen, who was on the national German team and is the fastest swimmer to ever hit the waters of Ironman. The Sailfish mission is to create premium triathlon and open water swim products, and with the Kona course record holder personally testing everything they make, you know you are getting something special when you order from Sailfish. They certainly offer swim skins, tri-suits, and swim accessories, but the core of the Sailfish product line are their award-winning wetsuits. Sailfish wetsuits are truly made to make you faster. And that certainly has been the case for me. I've swam in many different brands of wetsuits over the years, and my Sailfish is the very first one that I put on, got into the water, and clocked swim splits I had no business hitting on my own. With several models and price points, there for sure will be a Sailfish wetsuit that is right for you. So head to sailfish.com to check out all the neoprene goodness.
Whether you're training easy, training hard, recovering easy, or recovering hard, your heart is right there, beating on along, pumping blood, doing its thing. It's always up to something. And if we pay attention, our heart is always trying to tell us something. So let's talk to Coach Jeff and Coach Ryan and find out just what it's trying to tell us. And let's start nice and easy with our most relaxed heart rate possible. Guys, let's talk about our resting heart rate and what fitness implications are there for this number. Coach Jeff, what is our resting heart rate and what's it trying to tell us?
Yeah, this is a deep episode, and I like that we're kind of easing into some of this deep stuff. And like you said, our hearts, they're always beating. We're always idling, right? The ignition is never turned off. And so you're right. Our heart rate is always telling us something. And so our heart rate in general, right, it's the number of beats that our heart beats per minute. It can be measured manually at the carotid artery on the neck, the radial, that's a wrist on the thumb side, right? And also with heart rate monitors, right? And most resting heart rate norms are kind of in between that 60 to 80 for the average healthy person. So obviously we're all triathletes here, and we tend to be fitter than the average norm. And so most of us see a lower resting heart rate. So our body is doing less work at rest to maintain normal metabolic functioning, and it's more efficient in doing so. Just a quick science and nerd out. We have to go here for a brief second here. But
that's the point of today, Jeff. I want to learn all we can about heart rate. So please take us into the science lab and nerd out for us.
Let's do it. All right. Well, let's start with red blood cells. These red blood cells, they must load up appropriate quantities of oxygen to send to our tissues that are performing a certain activity. Right. The heart must then pump oxygen-rich blood, those red blood cells, oxygen-rich to those tissues, right? And it's got to do that rapidly enough to deliver the required amount of oxygen. In the tissue cell, the mitochondria, oxygen is required to make ATP. ATP is then used to fuel the activity. ATP is energy, so to speak, right? And so our heart rates, they will vary from person to person, right? Our heart rates depend on the intensity and also the energy requirements of a given activity. And so the fitter that you are, the more cardiovascular exercise you do, then the less demand there is to maintain that normal metabolic functioning at rest, and hence a lower resting heart rate.
Interesting.
Now, how much cardiovascular exercise that one needs depends on their individual goals, right? The average healthy person, I like and use, and in graduate school, referred to the American College of Sports Medicine, ACSM, and also the American Council of Exercise, ACE, A-C-E. They recommend 20 to 60 minutes of cardiovascular exercise from anywhere from kind of 3 to 5 days per week. That's just to maintain general health, right? Now, also ASM says that despite the well-known benefits of just being healthy, like physical activity is a global pandemic. And it has been identified as one of the four leading contributors to premature mortality. And so this lack of activity or physical inactivity, it's an epidemic, a pandemic, and across our nation. And so understanding how much physical activity we need, and also understanding how the heart works, is crucial for us as triathletes, but also just everyday life, being healthy, living longer.
And hearing all that, it's very, very interesting. My resting heart rate, and I should have just taken like a fresh look at it before we recorded this, but typically whenever I do glance at it first thing in the morning, or when I've been sitting for a while, I'm somewhere in the high 50s, I believe, resting heart rate. And my wife has always prided herself on the fact that her resting heart rate is typically a few beats lower than mine. And I obviously do a lot of cardio and a lot of Ironman training, a lot of triathlon training, and she does beach body workouts, but just despises going for a run or anything cardio related. That's always kind of been a point of bragging for her, is that like, hey, look at all this training you do, and my resting heart rate is lower than yours. So Jeff, are you implying that with that, my wife's base fitness is better than my own?
Could be, right? There's the famous "it depends" answer. Body type, genetics, a million other external factors I'm sure we'll talk about later on play
sure.
into that. But body size, just in general, it might have a higher demand to maintain that normal metabolic functioning. But if she trains and is very efficient and very fit, and maybe you not so much, let's say currently, then yeah, the answer could be yes, and it could be no.
Well, hey, great question. You know, I always appreciate the nerd out moments from Coach Raines, and it does save me some words here. Really, he really did knock that one out pretty well.
He covered it so well. Ryan Tibble can just sit there, drink your coffee, relax,
this
stay in zone 2.
This is a great cup of coffee. But I will add, as you become more cardiovascular fit, and your resting heart rate can and will typically lower, this is significant of obvious improved cardiac function, i.e. cardiac output. We all kind of geek out on that, as I do some cardiopulmonary exercise testing on the side, and it's so fun to really see the entire picture when we do these testings. But just like everything else in our body, the heart is a muscle, and it really it just needs that workout to strengthen. The associated improvements leads to improved stroke volume, the squeeze of that of the heart per heartbeat, or squeeze of that blood rather through that heart. We mentioned alternatively, if you are not well conditioned athlete and your resting heart rate is below normal, even or above normal ranges, as Jeff mentioned, you may want to consider seeing a physician. Get checked out before beginning any regimented exercise program. It's just very ideal. Just find that baseline and then you know where to begin. And then, hey, you know, you can look back as an athlete as you're beginning this process and kind of, again, reflect back and say, hey, wow, this is where I was and look where I'm at now. So just putting that in perspective.
So the other side of the spectrum is our max heart rate. And I hit this at the very end of my 5K time trials. Usually I'm starting to see spots, those last 0.2 miles of a 5K time trial, as my heart rate peaks at 189 to 190 beats per minute. What is the significance of our max heart rate?
Well, max heart rate by traditional standards is, and remember, mind you, this is traditional standards, is 220 minus your age. However, many well-conditioned athletes can go above the theoretical max. In fact, I have often exceeded this in 5Ks as well, like you, Andrew. In general, it's hard to sustain your heart rate above that theoretical max for very long, or sometimes even at all. To your point, Andrew, about seeing those spots, there is a natural association in blood pressure during exercise as well. It increases. That is that response that your body wants and needs to do. And hence the reason you may be seeing spots, or perhaps your spirit animal. So I still remember going into the 190s and some of those 5Ks back in the day, even sustaining a heart rate in the 170s during half marathons. I have to say those are the good old days for me. I'd love to hear Rain elaborate even more on this as well.
Yeah. I have administered many VO2 max tests back in the day, a submax test as well. And I participated in them as well. And I remember the highest heart rate I've ever seen back in my glory days, after collegiate running, I remember holding a 208 heart rate for a couple minutes at the end of a test one time. And now I would see spots going there, digging deep. But, you use the word theoretically in associated with max heart rate, right? I'll elaborate just briefly, really. Theoretically, right, max heart rate is associated with one's age. When we're born, our max heart rate is around 220 beats per minute, right? And each year of life, the max heart rate tends to reduce by about one. So again, theoretically, by age 20, our max heart rate should be around 200, right? That Carvonin theory of the 220 minus your age, right, is kind of where that comes from. There are updated and kind of more precise equations to that. One is called the Jelisch formula. It's your max heart rate is 207 minus what is your age multiplied by 70%. And so that tends to give a little bit more accurate, but each person, however, right, is unique and has their own unique fitness levels, their own strength, heart size. Tons of other factors play into why these numbers can vary up to about 10 to 15 beats per minute within different individuals of the same age. For max heart rate is a really cool factor that I use. Like, let's kind of steer it towards like us as triathletes, and training, relatively vigorously or consistently. I monitor the max heart rate during the testing. For example, your bike test, it's a sign of strength, right? Some people starting off, let's say, don't have enough strength to keep tension on the pedals for long enough at high efforts to let the heart rate go high. Right? Their physical fitness fails before the capacity of that heart rate to hit a max number. And so what I like to do...
And that is me on a bike, Jeff. That is me. Yeah.
And as you build strength, as you have more consistency, you will be able to, keep that tension high enough for long enough. The goal is to get as many watts on the average as we can for that 20-minute bike test, right? But there are also goals within that. Let's get a new max heart rate inside of that. It's, you know, and then I say, hey, what was your max heart rate of the test from 4 weeks ago? Okay, you hit 180. Well, let's try to hit 180 by minute 17 or 18 this time, and then hang on a little bit longer. Maybe get a new max heart rate personal record inside of that test. That's not the main goal, but it is a tool that you can use inside of that, and it's a sign of added strength as well as fitness. It's kind of cool to play around with that sometimes.
Yeah, and so Jeff, you mentioned right there even that with that formula, I mean, throughout our lives, there are things happening in our body that causes our max heart rate, our resting heart rate even to kind of change over time, changes in fitness. So I'm just kind of curious for an athlete as we go through the course of our lives, and then for male and female athletes, you mentioned some of it can be biological or genetic. I mean, how can we expect to see our max heart rate, our resting heart rate kind of change over time, just as we age as athletes?
You know, that's a good question. I think going from adolescence, an infant, and, you know, even into an adulthood, right? We there's a different goal of the body, right? As it relates to physical fitness components, right? So there's one, it's health related versus skill related. So I'll elaborate, right? In the beginning, we're simply trying to develop and create health-related physical fitness components. Then we progress into that skill-related physical fitness. So as a baby, child, adolescent, right, we're still developing. And our overall fitness components are developing, right? Just general cardio, you know, respiratory endurance, body composition, muscular strength, right? It hasn't even been established yet. So we're just trying to establish these things like muscular endurance, flexibility, a ton of things, right? But as we progress later on, right, we're trying to build a skill set around those physical fitness components. And we kind of switch into developing coordination, agility, you know, balance, power, reaction time, speed, you know, all those skill-related physical fitness components. And so during cardiovascular exercise, right, the heart must pump blood to the large muscles in the body. When a person is moving in a rhythmical pattern continuously for a period of time, right? The duration depends on an individual's ability to sustain that activity, right? And that's where fitness comes along and building that fitness, you know, greater than just the average norm or general health.
You know, I will also add, you know, say over the course of our lives, our 3 year theoretical max attainable heart rate declines proportionally. You know, as Coach Raines mentioned earlier, you know, about our max heart rate values, the formulas changed to calculate our dynamic depending on several factors: gender, age, your level of fitness, et cetera. Many, many factors go into that. In past studies, the differences between males and females, females do have a tendency to have a higher heart rate in general, physiologically speaking, because of their size in comparison to a male. Now, I know you mentioned earlier, Andrew, your wife often brags about having, you know, that lower resting heart rate. Well, you know,
she also has a higher max heart rate. So, you know, she just has a broader range all across the spectrum.
Yeah. So is she interested in having a coach? You know, we need to get her going, man.
She could be an amazing endurance athlete. Sure.
Absolutely. you know, and I'll use this as an example. You know, there is generally no significant difference in cardiac size between male and females until here's the key, the onset of puberty. After puberty, that changes and generally results in males having a slightly slower resting heart rate than women in comparison. Hormones obviously play a role, and that is something, you know, that we can go real deep into the weeds on for this. But, you know, to add to that, and we go a step further, you know, after menopause, there is no significant difference, which suggests a strong connection to even estrogen, according to ongoing research that is going out there.
So a big question, I think, for a lot of us, especially once we are on multiple apps that give you a heart rate zone, is how are these heart rate zones even determined? I mean, my Garmin thinks I'm in zone 3 at 150 beats per minute. Tread tells me that's still my zone 2. And I'm sure Strava and Zwift might say something entirely different. Whoopers probably swear by whatever their whoop zones are. What apps are right? And how do we actually know what our heart rate zones are?
This is a million-dollar question. We get this a lot. Like, who do I trust, right? Which one do I go off of? Why does this, you know, entity have six or seven zones and this one only five? Stuff like that, you know. And really it all comes down to, well, first of all, or like a lot's got to be considered when establishing and monitoring these heart rate zones. But whatever you're using or following, just know that those zones also change regularly as your fitness improves, disproves. And so it's constantly changing, adapting. But heart rates can be increased by a number of things. Zones can be affected, changed, hot and humid temperatures, just an individual's skill level, their individual skill level, their body mechanics, genetics, altitude, gosh, medications, lack of sleep, stress, caffeine intake, right? There's just so many things.
That's a lot of factors already. Yeah.
We could go on and on, right? And so really a lot of scholars recommend throwing in like the RPE scale inside of those zones and how you're feeling inside of those zones. The old Borg scale, that scale of 1 to 20 on a rate of perceived exertion, you know, are you a 10 out of 20? Are you 20 out of 20? Can't go anymore, right? Things like that. You can monitor other variables along with the RPE scale and following your heart rate. What if the heart rate is just weird on that day, right? What if your heart rate is very, very high?
Sure.
But you're just like, man, I'm only a 9 out of 10 or a 10 out of 20 on that Borg scale. But my heart rate's high, but I feel fine, right? And so there's always unique, it depends, right? Our HRV and all sorts of other things can be tied into and along with heart rate zones to make sure that they're accurate. But the biggest thing in establishing zones, whatever entity, if you're having seven zones or five, what they're paying attention to is called heart rate reserve, HRR, heart rate reserve. It's the difference between your max and your resting heart rate. Right. If you don't know what your max heart rate is, you can use that 220 minus age. Right. Well, as mentioned earlier, that can be flawed and not everybody's exactly that, but that's a good, decent starting spot. You might be new to training. You don't have a lot of fitness. You're not able to get your heart rate super high yet without hurting yourself. And so that's just a good safe point, 220 minus your age, or that Jelisch formula I mentioned before. But you got to know what that max heart rate is or have a decent idea of what that could be. Right. A 20-year-old may not be able to hit 200 beats per minute, right? 220 minus your age. If you're 20 years old, you know, you may not be able to hit 200 beats. But a 65-year-old might be able to easily hit 155, right? So we know that there's an it depends or could be a flaw in that formula, as we mentioned before. So then once that heart rate reserve is established, what that number is, it can be then used to set target heart rates, all right? So once you know your heart rate reserve, your THR, your target, is useful for determining your optimal training capacity, right, for a certain activity. For example, target zones, right, between, and these target zones have to fall somewhere between your resting and max, right? Our resting heart rate, right, you said your wife's is you know, in the 40s and in 50s, right? And so we're starting at 40 or 50, not at zero, because the lowest heart rate that that someone might see is 45, right? And so it's not just a percentage of 220 minus your age, right? We have to subtract out that resting heart rate. And so what's left over is that target heart rate zone, right? And those target zones fall in between that, between the resting and max. And they fall into usually three main categories, kind of an easy aerobic intensity, a moderate intensity activity, and then a vigorous intensity, right? So once you find out what the target heart rate range is, you take percentages of that. It might be 60, 70, and 85%, right? And so that kind of establishes kind of five ends, five pieces of the pie, let's say, right? To find that target heart rate, I have to throw out this one more equation, I know. But if you take that heart rate reserve and you multiply it by a percent intensity, right? And you take that number and then you add the resting heart rate, that's how you establish target heart rate zones, all right? So moderate intensity, let's say cardio, right, is estimated to be anywhere from 40 to 59% of your heart rate reserve. Vigorous activity, though, might be 60 to 89% of your heart rate reserve, right? So there are formulas that entities use as a when in doubt maybe just a you know, a blanket algorithm, we'll call it, to establish those zones.
I do want to encourage people, Jeff, as you're throwing around a lot of percentages and numbers and equations, this will probably be a very good episode for our listeners to take the time later today or another day when you're in front of a computer on the website for the Trot Out Podcast, where the podcast episodes are listed. If you click on an individual episode, the transcripts of word for word what our coaches said do get added to our webpage, usually a few days to a week after the episode releases. So wait a week or so and then circle back to the webpage for this episode. This would be a very, very good transcription to pull up to just kind of get a visual. I can see the equations these guys are saying. We all have our notes for this episode in front of us. I can see, Jeff, as you're talking, 40% to 59% and this and that. Like, it's very, very, very great. It's a great learning opportunity having the numbers in front of you as you're hearing what Jeff is saying. So maybe you never knew that we have the transcriptions to our podcast. I want to give a shout out to there's two Trot Out ambassadors, Holly and Jamie, that go in, listen to the episode as soon as it releases and help us get those transcripts created. So that you can see what our coaches are saying. With all the math and the science on this episode, this is probably a good one to visualize the information at some point on our website with the transcription. Jeff, please continue.
Yeah, and I'll add this, and that's a good point. Trot Out does all this for you at a much deeper level. They're not just blanket equations. I mean, so much more goes into it. Trot Out establishes your zones. All you got to do is do your assessment, put in the results and the average heart rate achieved during that assessment, and your zones are done for you. So you don't have to know this, even understand it. You don't have to memorize those equations. This is just how a lot of entities do it when in doubt. And I will say that other entities that are kind of using these formulas, your zones are only as good as what you tell that app. You have to tell your app, right, what is your max heart rate? What is your resting heart rate? And then they go in and establish these zones for you using some of these equations, right? And so they're only as good as what you tell the app, right? And so TriDot establishes it by a much deeper, intensive, more accurate type way. So I will throw that out there. But really, most use five zones, right? And why these zones are not universal amongst all platforms is due to how they label or categorize the percentages for target heart rate. For example, right, Garmin has five zones. They label zone one warm up, easy, aerobic, threshold, and max. Right. Some other platforms, let's just say like Zwift, for example, they have six zones: recovery, endurance, tempo, threshold, VO2 max, and anaerobic, which is greater than a 119%. Right, and some of that's power versus heart rate. And then some allocate like a zone three into tempo or the dead zone and stuff like that. And so it kind of just depends the philosophy behind the entity. TriDot uses six zones to differentiate the types of stress, like that stress response that's going to be elicited in the goal of that workout, right? And so our zones are easy, endurance, tempo, threshold, super threshold, and maximal. So no matter who you are, your aerobic threshold will fall into what is your zone two. Right, your unique internal physiological aerobic threshold is going to fall, you know, in that zone two range. Your anaerobic threshold is going to fall into that zone four. Zone five and above threshold is above threshold, right? And the goal there is to elicit more of a physical external stressor, kind of like hill repeats, low cadence work on the bike. Maybe you're going to get off the bike and do some squats. So the goal there is to elicit kind of a physical stressor, kind of an external. Right. And then that zone six is like a maximal effort, and it's a neural hormonal stress response that's trying to be elicited.
We had, you know, Rains, Coach Rains, always, you know, with the great information there. And I don't have a whole lot to add to that because that was perfect. Well said. And, you know, like I said, regarding what we have seen at TriDot for our heart rates and what we use as that six zone model, this is 100% based on the research and looking at multiple models here at TriDot. You know, there are multiple factors that go into the decision, not just solely based on one variable, as Rains mentioned. We are always studying and looking at ongoing research to better understand what models we do use. There are other companies, as again, Coach Rains mentioned, the 5-zone models, and some even use the 7-zone model that I have seen at Lifetime. There's not necessarily an industry standards, as this seems to be, you know, continually evolving. But, you know, as we're looking at the data and continually evaluating what heart rate ranges are best for our athletes, this will continue to evolve as more data that we get from our athletes is utilized. You know, with all that said, it is best to match your HR zones, your heart rate zones from TriDot to Garmin and other apps, and follow your TriDot zones exclusively to avoid that confusion while we're all training.
Yeah, good point.
There's a high value of regular assessments to keep your heart rate zones updated so you train appropriately, do the right training right.
Company man with a company slogan, and all a great point. And I've certainly gone on the Garmin before and updated my zones so that they match and Garmin doesn't yell at me thinking I'm in the wrong zone. That's a great point there from Coach Ryan. So a frequent thing that comes up with TriDot training specifically is making sure that we stay in zone 2 heart rate on our easy runs and rides. And the reason being that there are certain physiological adaptations that occur at each zone. When we train in zone 2, it's doing something different from our bodies than when we train in zone 4, in zone 5, zone 6. So I just kind of want to hear from you guys, just a summation of, for each zone, those 6 zones that TriDot uses, what is happening physically in our bodies as we train in that zone? And then because of that, why does TriDot give us X amount of time spent in that zone? Coach Ryan.
You know, there's a lot to unpack here, but, you know, we'll try to, you know, keep it pretty summarized pretty well.
I have faith. I believe. Yeah.
You know, Z1, you know, I like to say that's where I'm at right now in my heart rate, but it's been a hot yeah. minute since I've been on a podcast. So, but that is our low aerobic, our very relaxed recovery zone, very low stress, you know, and again, like I mentioned, I think, you know, if I look at my watch, I'm just kind of sitting in that area right now. So thankfully, zone 2 is what I like to say, our comfortable conversational pace. You know, it should be able to have, again, you go off for that run or riding, rather in enjoying a nice conversation with your fellow athlete friends, et cetera. This is our base aerobic zone that often serves as that nice recovery zone. It does elicit that fat burning. Some say nice cheap energy that we have it to burn, and also helps build that aerobic endurance and big foundation. I often emphasize this with my athletes. It's like, listen, let's not stand on a pedestal with our aerobic base. Let's make this giant foundation. And so it's going to set you up for success, especially as we get into that long course racing. It's going to be so important for metabolically speaking, for that aerobic fat metabolism. You produce more ATP. This is a great default zone. And you often, again, as you see, we're training and we'll be spending that time in that zone 4, but then we drop into that recovery, re-access, re-energize in that zone 2. And again, you can continually work in that to optimize your physiological adaptations for cardiovascular efficiency and aerobic capacity. Zone 3, oftentimes called our tempo zone, sometimes called a kind of a bit of a gray zone. This is often very, very specific to especially our half iron distances, and is developed with work in it really, truly developed and work in a sandwich kind of manner. You got your zone 4 work we've been doing. We got our zone 2. And, well, what's in between? It's that zone 3. It doesn't really facilitate recovery as like zone 2 does. So it's not, again, not something you should be running in to recovery purposes, rather, but it's very specific to specific distances you may be covering in your future racing. So there are still, again, those becoming familiar with zone 3, practicing in it, like you see your prescribes in your race rehearsals or, you know, race prep phase rather, then again, it's familiarizing your feeling. You get that RPE feel to it as well. Zone 4, our all time favorite, really, our grip building zone, our uncomfortable, right? But hugely beneficial in developing our anaerobic capacity. Your body is now forced to utilize carbohydrates as its main source of fuel and teaches the body with consistent work to withstand and process that lactic acid. Lactic acid is then, going deep a little here, but goes, gets oxidized and produces more CO2 and water as the byproducts. And so therefore your respirations, coming from the respiratory background, it really increases your CO2 production as well. And as you see with our programming, Z4 intervals, they do vary in durations, again, continually to, build that grit and being uncomfortable, embracing that uncomfortable feeling. So it's so important. Go for several minutes all the way up to that beloved 20 minutes, possibly, if you ever seen those pop up on your training. Whew, I tell you, those are...
Because Ryan, in zone three, you're working, right? And zone four, you're really working. And then in zone five and six, you're really, really, really working. That's kind of the anecdotal way of quantifying it. And in zone two, that's like, if you're in zone two, you shouldn't feel like you're working all that hard, which that's the Andrew Harley RPE scale. Not really working, working, really working, really, really working, really, really, really working.
Yes, absolutely. And, like you said, alluding to that zone five, our beloved VO2 max zone, often say, it is genetically limited, but oftentimes we don't hit our genetic potential. But I also do, tell people, hey, you know what? Make sure you choose your parents wisely. There's your bad joke for the day. And
I appreciated that.
Thank you, Coach Raines. But it does help pull, per se, your fitness up. So you just start to, you work in that zone five, you get it stronger, you move it up. And so guess what the zones below it do? They come on up with it. And so, that is, again, not a zone we work in weekly, but it is strategically placed in your programming so that you can recover from these very intense sessions in that zone five. And then lastly, zone six with its neurological benefit. Jeff Raines touched on that very well as well. It improves that anaerobic power, particularly over very short durations. And again, as you get that stronger and stronger, it pulls the other zones with it. And so it's a really nice to do those, but again, it's even less often than that zone five work.
So I know there's a lot of people that are familiar with the 80-20 rule. And so that's kind of where we talk when we talk about how much time we need to be spending in each heart rate zone, in each intensity in our training. The 80-20 principle basically estimates you should probably spend 80% of your time training at zone two, easier paces, and you should spend 20% of your training zone four and above at harder paces, harder intensities. And there are some people that by their age, by their biology, by who they are, 80-20 is the right split for them. But if you're a younger male, for example, that might be more like 85-15. Your body might be able to take on the physical stress of spending a little more time at 70-30 rather. You can spend a little bit more time working harder than somebody who might be a little bit older. So TriDot knows your biology, and it knows based on your age, who you are, your history in the sport, how much training stress you can handle in each of these zones. So Jeff, I'm curious for you to just kind of have the chance to really help break it down for us. What determines how much time in TriDot training we spend in each zone, and why is it more zone two and more zone four through six and less zone three, for example?
That's a great question. And it's almost the universal question. And so many people have their different thoughts on it. But for the most part, you're right. The majority of your training should be at lower intensities. You have greater adaptations, greater just general health benefits, and kind of even alluding to what Tibble was saying earlier, about like the zone four, five, and six, our beloved VO2 max, right? Our beloved zone five, right? That really high intensity above threshold. People think like, well, to improve my threshold, if my threshold falls in what is that zone four, And I want to raise that, right? I want to improve my watts. I want to get stronger and faster. So for me to improve my zone four, my threshold, I have to do a lot of zone five and zone six, right? To raise that, right? Well, that's actually wrong, and it's the misconception. It's almost even a myth. And so what TriDot does, like you said, it monitors so many awesome deeper variables that most people don't even know, and that's a whole other podcast. But basically, each person has a unique ability and capacity to handle certain stressors. Just because you have your zones established, they're different per discipline, but they're also different between heart rate, power, and pace. So there's just a lot going on, right? So we have to set up the zones, push it across different disciplines. What's the coinciding power and pace, right? And then you push it against swimming versus biking versus running. And once you do all that, then you have to figure out what Andrew said. Well, what percentages of those zones of the minutes per week do I spend in certain zones, right? And that's just crazy, right? So hopefully I didn't lose you there, but there's a lot going on. And the beauty of TriDot, it does it all for you. You don't have to know and understand it. You just know that if you do your assessments, everything is updated for you. But then you have like Andrew's question, the 80-20, right? So when in doubt, if 80% of your training is at zone two, you're kind of safe. You know, you don't want to do too much quality. You don't want 50% of the minutes you spent that entire week training to be all in zone five and zone six. Even though you might have completed it or felt good in the moment, you're hindering other workouts. You're causing immunities and hormonal levels to be unique or imbalanced. And so there is a method, there is an art and a science behind it. But I'll end with this. Just like that kind of quote 95% rule in establishing FTP, right? Functional threshold bike power is the highest attainable average watts you could hold for about 1 hour, 60 minutes. But it's hard for a lot of people to pace correctly for an hour and do an hour test, right? Or if they're new to training, they don't have the fitness to do it for an hour, or there's a pacing aspect, right? If they don't pace perfectly, they won't have their right threshold value, or it's so long that it becomes an endurance event. And so what do? We do a 20-minute test, right? But there's this rule out there that you have to take 95% of the 20-minute test, and that is what that person could hold for 1 hour, and that is their threshold. I mean, I think that just kind of like, you know, the 80-20, like when in doubt, that's a good thing to follow. Just like 220 minus your age. If you don't know, you know, that might be a close value. There's always an it depends. But how is everybody in the world as unique, different, you know, your unique internal physiological threshold is so different and unique per person to person. How is everybody in the world's unique threshold, exactly 95% of that 20-minute test, and that's what they could hold for an hour, right? And then what if you
did? They can be. They can be.
Yeah, right? And just like everybody in the world doesn't have to have 80% of their week in zone two exactly. It's a good when in doubt. Again, I have to throw that out there. But TriDot knows all of these things, and it is catering specifically to you, right? And so TriDot doesn't merely apply that 95% rule to establish your threshold. Many other things are factored in there. Age, genetics, the conditions at which you do the test, right? You go do your 5K and coaches establish thresholds based off of percentage of that finish time to establish pace zones. But what if you did that 5K in 100 degrees and it was super hot? Your body probably thinks you ran a lot faster internally, right? And so all of those come into effect with TriDot. And I just love the way that you can trust and know that TriDot is taking all these things into an account.
Yeah, and when we market TriDot training as data driven, there's just a lot more that goes into it than what any human coach or any human athlete could design for themselves. I mean, these are just some of the things that we're talking about that go into generating what your zones are, what your training plan is, how long you're holding each interval and each workout. There's a lot going on underneath the hood. And again, if you're curious to see some of the exact numbers that Jeff Rains is throwing out there, talking about 95% of the 20-minute FTP test and some of those things, this is an excellent, excellent episode to give us a week and then pull up the webpage for this episode and read his transcription of all the science that he gave us there. Really, really, really fascinating stuff on how our training is designed based off of all these rules. Moving us along, though, because not every training session we have is prescribed by heart rate. It's good to know our heart rate zones. It's good to have those heart rate zones. And then there's training sessions where all we pay attention to is staying in a certain heart rate zone. But there are also training sessions that are prescribed by pace and power. And all of a sudden, you're not paying attention to your heart rate anymore. You're paying attention to staying, running at an 8-minute mile, for example, or pushing X amount of watts on the bike for X amount of time, for example. So when we have a session that isn't heart rate based, are there still reasons to pay attention to our heart rate in these sessions, or can it just absolutely go by the wayside?
Absolutely, Andrew, 100%. You know, and that is a very great question. Oftentimes I do, and very much so, keep an eye on my heart rate, even in those prescribed pace or power workouts. I think it's very important. I watch not only mine, I watch my athletes' heart rates in those sessions in that are prescribed in those pace and power. I like to look at trends over time. And I think, as coaches, it's a valuable tool, trending an athlete's heart rates through these harder sessions. It can, and with the aid, especially with TriDot giving us that training stress load and really going into those hard calculations of quantifying that training stress, it is important to see heart rate throughout these workouts. So I always recommend wearing your heart strap, even in when you have these power and pace workouts. Knowing how heart rate is affected not only by intensity in your workouts, but also with hydration, nutrition, stress, recovery, the environment. And I say thank God for environment normalization at TriDot. That way we can train appropriately, train right. Doing the right training right. Maybe we should have that extra bottle of precision hydration next to us on that trainer as you're watching your heart rate creep up and even decoupling a bit. You're like, oh, wait a minute, what's going on here? Maybe we need some extra nutrition too while we're at it.
Yeah, let's talk about heart rate decoupling, because that's something that's come up several times on the podcast. And that term, for anybody who's not familiar with it, that's the point where our heart rate begins to drift away from or decouple from where it should be at a certain intensity. So if my heart rate running 8-minute miles is usually 150 beats per minute, and all of a sudden I'm an hour into a workout where I'm running at that pace, and all of a sudden my heart rate is starting to creep up to 155, 160, 165, and my pace has not changed. My intensity has not changed. My heart rate has now decoupled from where it should be at that 8-minute mile. Why is it important for us as athletes to notate when this happens in a workout or on race day, and what usually causes this to happen?
Love it. Heart rate decoupling. Let's go.
Hit it.
So like you said, when your heart rate drifts away from the power or pace that you have maintained, right, that steady state in a workout, and nothing else has changed, right? So your power is constant. Your body positioning is constant. Your cadence is constant. Your nutritional intake is constant, right? You're doing all of these things right. Right? Hurry up and wait. That's Ironman. We want to keep our watts about the same, our heart rate the same, get, from start to finish, the same intensity, feeling good. But let's say you're doing all of that perfectly. Everything's constant. Everything's good. Your breathing rate. It's not like you're waiting an hour. Oh, crud, I didn't drink. And then you chug a whole bottle at the last minute of every hour, right? It's just that good, safe, constant, consistent intake. Everything is stabilized and consistent and maintained. But like you said, Andrew, what if your heart rate starts to climb a little bit? You got a 4-hour ride, right? The last 30 to 60 minutes, you kind of see that heart rate climb up by maybe 8 to 10 beats. You're like, whoa, what's going on here? I know I'm 3.5 hours into a 4-hour ride. My heart rate's going up a little bit here, but nothing's changed. It's not like I just like increased my cadence by 20 and just started like blasting the legs and my heart rate climbed. The only thing that has changed is my heart rate starting to climb a little bit. What's up with that? That's decoupling, right? And so identifying like your heart rate decoupling, it's a very effective way to like gauge just current aerobic ability, right? If you have a 4-hour ride, but you could only maintain it perfectly for 3.5, there's something off, right? It could be aerobic fitness. It could be that aerobic ability, or it could be an external factor like Tibble was talking about, right? Maybe you're low on nutrition. Right, or something like that, and now you're dehydrated, and now your blood is thickening. Well, now to get the same amount of oxygen and fuel to the working muscle, your heart rate, your heart has to beat harder and faster to get the same amount of fuel to the muscle, and to get that amount of fuel there, it's got to beat more, right? And so that's decoupling, and having a strong aerobic endurance It's essential if you want to perform at your best in longer distances, right? And that's why, you know, developing that aerobic fitness is key. And what we focus on in that race prep phase, that stamina phase, I call it, right? The fast before far, strong before long. And so, you know, those last few months or the last portion of your season as you ramp up, we're really, really developing that stamina. Right. And that's when the workouts get longer. And that's when you can start paying a little bit more attention to that heart rate decoupling and what your aerobic endurance is. But experiencing that decoupling could mean a number of things. Right. Something could or should need to be adjusted. Dehydration. Right. We talked about the blood thickening. You need more fuel to sit to the working muscle, stuff like that. But maybe it's just a cadence strategy needs adjusting. Or your intensity needs to be lessened by 10 watts, right? Or environmental conditions change, right? Maybe at the start of your Ironman 112-mile bike ride, it's 55 degrees. But mile 90, maybe it's 95 degrees, right? So if your intensity is the exact same watts all day long, right? And you start to see heart rate decoupling. Well, what if it's just because it's hotter out there and there's more demand put on the body, right? So there's so many things to pay attention to. But I like to do some of my longer rides indoors. Yes, you want to get outdoors and technical skills and bike handling and all that. But I like to have maybe every third ride kind of in that stamina phase to be indoors where I can control the environment, right? The temperature and my pain cave is the same. My cadence is the same. The watts are the same. There's not a hill or wind or something that's so that I can really pay attention to what that aerobic fitness is. And if I see that decoupling, okay, the last 30 minutes, my heart rate got high, right? I only averaged 24 ounces of fluids per hour for that ride. Well, maybe I want to up it to 28 ounces the next week or the next time. Oh, the heart rate decoupling didn't happen. Well, maybe it was because I was dehydrated. Maybe I need 4 extra ounces per hour. Things like that. Those are just examples.
So let's wrap our heart rate conversation today with a question about race day. And I do have a question on the sheet here about heart rate variability. I do want to throw that out there because I know some people are probably listening to this episode hoping that we talk about heart rate variability. Y'all, that is a long conversation. That is a deep conversation, that a step deeper than this one. Recently, our team was at Endurance Exchange, a conference that USA Triathlon hosts every single year. And many of us sat in on a conversation about heart rate variability. So that will come as a separate podcast episode in the near to mid future. I'm going to skip it for today just for time. So let's wrap up with this one. On race day, we've got our watches. You know, we've got our heart rate monitors. We've got whatever it is that we're using to measure those sweet beats per minute. For me, it's my Garmin 955. How much should we be paying attention to our heart rate throughout a race versus just going off of pace or how we're feeling?
In my opinion and coaching opinion, it is very important metric to follow during racing. I often refer to heart rate as what I call the governor. You think about the governor on a car, you know, some of these high fast speed cars that they import from across the country to bring here, they often put governors on them, meaning they restrict them. And so that's why I refer to heart rate as a governor when you're racing. Because it serves, your heart rate serves as an internal feedback mechanism, if you will, telling you, you might need nutrition, hydration to slow down, or even perhaps maybe even speed up. You have room when you're staying in your zones. And so you should absolutely monitor it when racing. In fact, get into good practice of monitoring it while training as well. It is especially, you know, especially again, during those long sessions, those long course racing. Be intentional while racing in that zone that is your coach has prescribed to you, and complete your race with, again, that beautiful smile on your face, knowing that you did it right.
Oh, man, good stuff. I love that. I agree 100%. You know, and I tell my athletes that heart rate will trump or it does trump power and pace, and especially at some point and especially in long course, right? If you're at mile 50 of the Ironman bike, you're not even halfway. And your power's in good low zone 3, right? But your heart rate's kind of well up into zone 4, right? Zone 4 we talked about is your threshold zone, right? You can only hold threshold on the bike for about 60 minutes, right? So if you've got potentially 3 or more hours left of the race, you're not even halfway on the bike, and your heart rate's in zone 4, and arguably 30 to 60 minutes max, right? Something's got to give. right? You can't hold that threshold effort for more than that 60 minutes. And so, right, you'll fatigue, you'll cramp, DNF, you'll walk most of the run, whatever that is. And so even if you're holding a great low wattage or a safe wattage, and if your heart rate's telling you something else, right, like Tibble was saying, you have to listen to it, right? And so definitely go out at power pace like you trained, but keep an eye on that heart rate, and there is a point where it will trump power and pace.
Great set, everyone. Let's cool down.
Welcome to the cool down, everyone. I'm Vanessa, your average triathlete with elite level enthusiasm. I am really looking forward to today's coach cool down tip because I have here with me TriDot coach Tony Washington. Tony is a corporate pilot and has the dreamiest work perk ever. He gets to bring his bike with him and ride all over the world. So I'm a little bit jealous because that sounds incredible. He has lived in seven different states and currently resides in Illinois. He has three kids, and he is also a grandpa with the newest grandbaby only a month old. On the triathlon side of things, Tony has been a TriDot athlete for 8 years, coaching for 6 years, and a TriDot coach for 3 years. Tony was a collegiate swimmer who can still lay down some blistering paces and has helped tons of athletes improve their swim times. He has coached athletes from a wide range of backgrounds and across all race distances, from super sprints all the way through to fulls. Tony is infectiously positive and helps people train their bodies as well as their minds. Welcome to the show, Tony.
Hey, it's great to talk to you again. I haven't seen you since Ambassador Camp. We do have a ton in common, don't we? Tiny world.
Yeah, right? I actually distinctly remember the first time that you and I met, Tony. It was on the way up Snow Canyon in St. George, Utah, the Ambassador Camp, and I heard someone coming up behind me, and all of a sudden, there you were beside me with the biggest smile on your face, which was on the same level as my own smile. So I knew that we were destined to know each other, because are there any people that have grins on their faces while riding up Snow Canyon? Now, for all of you listeners out there, just picture two people who love climbing hills on their bikes amongst the red rocks. It was a truly magical moment.
It was a great day. All the red rocks and the gorgeous blue sky. And it was probably 50, 60 of us or something out riding up Snow Canyon, this iconic climb in St. George. And it was fun trying to keep up with all you Canadians. That was a great time. It was a great day.
That was a really good time. So what tip do you have for us today, Tony?
Hey, for me, swimming is my thing. And I think one of the key things is head position and what it has an effect on your stroke and your balance. I like to tell people that most people look too far forward when they're swimming. They're trying to, that's coming from swimming in the pool where to looking where you're going to make your turn, that kind of thing. So I like to have people think about what their head is doing while they're swimming. Because if your eyes are too far forward, your feet tend to sink.
Yes. I actually understand this because I used to be one of those eyes up when I was swimming type of people. And I had a couple of coaches say to me, like, you know, you might want to drop your chin. And I felt it was so interesting because I thought I was looking straight down at the bottom of the pool. But in reality, I actually wasn't looking at the bottom of the pool. I was looking ahead. So do you have any cues for people to help them recognize if their head position is not totally correct and they think that they're actually that they actually have their head in the right position?
Well, it's funny you talk about your chin and what people are talking about. But one of the things I think about is most of the time when they turn to breathe is when your head really comes too far up because your eyes are out of the water, but your mouth is still in the water. So when I think about turning to breathe is I think about my chin coming out of the water and looking out at the side of the pool. And that helps keep your head, shoulders and hips balanced when you're turning to breathe and hopefully keep your body upright and balanced.
I see. And are there any specific drills that you can recommend for people to practice their head positioning?
Definitely. When you turn to breathe, look at the side of the pool and think about how high your eyes are going up. If you can see the ceiling, your head and eyes are too far up and your feet are sinking. So think about that chin. And during pool school, we kind of talk about Popeye mouth and how you want your mouth and chin to be out of the water versus just your whole head.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. And do you, I know that some people talk about having like a really nice pocket of air to breathe in when they do turn their head. Is there some way that you can describe what that feels like or what that looks like?
Definitely. If you ever see in the front of a boat, when there's dolphins out in front of the boat or something, and right off the bow of there's a big wave in front of the boat, that's kind of the front of your head. But if you look right behind there, there's a big gap. And if you're doing it right, your mouth is going to fall in that gap. So you can barely turn your head and breathe out of that gap and turn your head back straight. One of the things I just started using form goggles, and because of the displayed image, I discovered that my head moves a lot more than I thought. So now I'm aiming that image in the bottom of the lane line and trying to not to move it out of the way. And literally, I've done two swims now with these, and it's knocked a second off my 100 just because I now hold my head even more still than I used to.
Okay. So clearly, we need to pay attention to where our eyes are looking when our head is submersed under the water. And we need to pay attention to where our eyes are looking when we take a breath. And then we also want to make sure that we are not moving our head very much at all. I didn't realize that moving your head could have that great of an impact on your time, actually. That's crazy.
It really does. When you think about it, when your head's moving around, all you're doing is creating drag. And in pool school, we kind of talk about drag and how water's 800 times more dense than air. And we're always really hyper concerned with our aerobikes and tiny little tweaks, but the tiniest little change you're making to your body position has a huge effect on your speed through the water.
Thanks for joining us. Make sure to subscribe and share the TriDot podcast with your triathlon crew. For more great tri content and community, connect with us on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. Ready to optimize your training? Head to TriDot.com. and start your free trial today. TriDot, the obvious and automatic choice for triathlon training.